Chapter the Ninth. My emotions might as well have been a stampede of wild horses, they knocked me so witless. Yet I must admit one of my numerous feelings ran clearly and triumphantly in the fore. Sheerest glee! How the mighty had fallen! The match flame had travelled down the stick until it burned Sherlock's fingers. Dropping his light, he said something unrepeatable, and from the darkness above his head I told him, "Shame on you." Even as the match went out, I saw him startle in a most satisfactory manner. "Who's there?" he demanded, his voice reaching skyward. "Shush!" I whispered, glee running away and terror taking its place. "You'll rouse the mastiff."
"Who is it?" His tone softened, yet sharpened. "Bridget?"
"Do I sound like an Irish woman?" My wits had begun to rally and mental functions to take hold. "What have you done with the mastiff?"
"Fed it chopped beef a la bromide." He lit another match and held it high, trying to see me, yet he did not rise to his feet. I saw that he had taken his right boot off, and his foot stuck out before him, quite swollen within its stocking, either sprained or broken.
Instantly overrun by concern, I forgot all else. "You're hurt!"
At the same time he yelped, "Enola!"
Apparently he recognized, if not my shadowy face, then my unfortunately distinctive voice. "Do hush! I'll get you out!"
Already unfastening the carpet bag from my waist, I changed my mind and reached into my bosom first. Sherlock demanded, "Enola! What in heaven's name?
You pop up everywhere. What?"
"One might well say the same thing of you and Mycroft, always and forever in my way. Here." I dropped a generous length of bandaging on his lap.
"Wrap your foot in that. Wait."
I let a little flask of brandy fall on top of the bandaging.
"Drink some for the pain. Then bandage your ankle as tightly as you can. Here are scissors."
"No, thank you. My penknife will serve. I need nothing more, I assure you."
His light had once again gone out, and I could not see his face, but I heard a tremor of laughter, and, dare I say it, a kind of warmth in his voice.
"Unless, perhaps, you have a ladder in your pocket?"
"Indeed I do. Or at least I had a rope in my carpet-bag, in order to rescue—" Good heavens, whom should I attempt to save first, my brother or the unfortunate Cecily? I longed to linger with Sherlock, for I felt that, given even a brief acquaintance, I could confide in him as I never could in Mycroft. I wanted to explain to Sherlock why I had run away, because I could not be corseted, either literally or figuratively, into any conventional feminine mould, and I wanted to assure him of my regard, and most especially I wanted to ask him whether he had found any communications from Mum to me when he had gone back to search her rooms at Ferndal. Never again might I have such an opportunity for conversation with my brother, unafraid that he might seize me, yet I could have wept with vexation, for there was no time. Not while Lady Cecily remained in such horrifying difficulties. Thrusting all other thoughts aside, therefore, I demanded,
"Lady Theodora hired you?"
Sherlock blurted,
"How on earth do you know of this matter?"
His unguarded reply confirmed my hope. Lady Theodora opposed the forced marriage of her daughter.
"I knew it!" I cried. "I knew she would never, no such loving mother would ever—"
But a fearsome thought struck me.
"How was she able to approach you?"
"You seem to know all about it,"
Sherlock grumbled from the depths of the ha-ha, his breath seething between his teeth as he yanked at the bandaging, binding his hurt foot.
"What do you think?"
"I think Sir Eustace has her confined to her chambers. So how did she manage—"
"Draw your own conclusions."
"Doing so, one must conclude that Sir Eustace has separated mother and daughter, imprisoning the latter here, judging by your presence."
"And yours?"
"Was something arranged? Is Lady Cecily expecting your visit tonight?"
Crankily he shot back,
"Is she expecting yours?"
I pressed my lips together, puffing with exasperation.
"Just tell me, was something arranged?"
Silence for a moment. Then,
"No," he admitted. "I found no way to communicate with her."
"Enola, but you're sure she's held here?"
"No secret of that. They take her out in a landau for a daily airing."
"Odd," I murmured.
"Yes. I also think it odd that they should risk her escape for the sake of show. but perhaps a restraint of some sort hidden beneath her clothing binds her to the seat.
Perhaps. But why on earth does she not scream for help?
Sherlock retorted. Good heavens, Enola, the unfortunate girl is a baronet's daughter, not such a hoyden as you.
Hoyden? Was that what he called a free-thinking, independent female? As for Cecily, if he thought her meek and mannerly, he did not know her as well as I did. My dear brother, I will allow your insult and your ignorance to pass, I told him pleasantly. As you are here to free Lady Cecily, evidently, I suggest we join forces, if you will promise me upon your honour not to attempt any infringement upon my liberty. Join? Are you out of your minuscule mind? Stung, I shot back. Am I the one in the ditch with a lamed foot? I fear my tone rather inflamed him.
Whatever my mischance, your place is not here. Go home, girl, where you belong.
A comment quite unworthy of him, I thought, and not deserving of a reply. Giving none, I turned my attention to opening my carpet-bag.
For the matter of that, Enola, do you have a home?
He continued in heightened tones.
Where are you living all this time, and how?
Ignoring him, I extracted the rope from the carpet-bag while I mentally enumerated the latter's remaining contents. Curling irons to drive into the ground, were it necessary to fasten the rope to something, a cast-iron meat tenderizer by way of club, a truncated croquet mallet, and some other tools. I hefted the bag to be sure. Yes, weight enough.
Does any respectable and responsible older person have a care for you?
Closing the carpet-bag, I tied one end of the rope firmly to its handle. The rest of the rope I laid out upon the ground until I was sure I had provided sufficient slack. Then I tucked a loop of its remaining length into my belt in such a manner that I would not lose it, yet could yank it free at a moment's notice.
If not, then you cannot possibly be safe. Any female dwelling alone is a magnet for crime.
Turning my back on him, I rose, and with rope trailing behind me like a tail, two tails, actually, the one to the carpet-bag and the other loose end, I strode to the nearest tree, embraced its trunk, and began to make my way upward. I strained my every nerve and fibre in order to do so. The beech is the most difficult of all trees to climb, for the trunk is straight and exceedingly tall, with smooth silver bark as glossy as satin. Only the utmost necessity, and I admit a great deal of petty pride, I would show the great Sherlock Holmes who needed to have a care for whom. Only extremity drove me to attempt my ascent. Gritting my teeth, wasting no breath on naughty words that came to mind, I crept upward, clinging, from time to time slipping back despite my best efforts, fervidly wishing that the blood of Darwin's monkeys ran a bit stronger in my veins, as I grappled and clawed with hands rubbed raw, tried to grip with the soles of my boots. If only I could grasp with my feet like a chimpanzee! Still, I persevered, every portion of my personage stinging with exertion until I attained a height of perhaps 20 feet above the ground, sufficient so that I could look down on the ditch, and although I could not see into it, I felt sure that my brother, looking up, could see me. And just as I triumphantly thought this, my head struck something. Metal. What in the name of the devil?
Diabolical indeed, I discovered as I looked up to study the obstacle. Just below the point where the beech trunk began to branch, someone had placed a steel collar, the sort of thing one might use to try to keep squirrels off a bird feeder, only much larger, of course. No wonder any villains in residence here felt safe allowing copper beeches to overhang their sunk fence. I could climb no farther.
And I fear I then whispered something quite unforgivable, for I had hoped to gain the security of the branches before I deployed the rope.
Ye gods! Ye gods in dirty breeches! Ye gods with great hopping fleas!
But I refused to admit defeat. Wasting no more breath on useless commentary, gripping hard to the beech trunk with three of my limbs, with the fourth I took the rope from my belt and began to pull up the end attached to the carpet-bag. I required the assistance of my teeth to hold the rope each time I shifted my hand. If I should lose my grip, the consequences were barely thinkable. Meanwhile, all my limbs had begun to tremble and weaken, placing me in extreme danger. It seemed an eternity before I had it, the carpet-bag swinging within a few feet of me. I knew I could not cling to the beech trunk much longer without falling. I needed to take aim and throw without fail, for I might have no second chance.
Eyeing a sizable bough that jutted in the proper direction, I swung my arm so that the bag described an arc in the air and swung once again, then once more to make sure as I let go. The carpet-bag, as clumsy a fowl as ever flew, blundered aloft, seemed to hang vulture-like in the air for a moment, then fell. Yes! Oh, yes, thank goodness! The rope lay over the bough. Now I had only to manoeuvre until the carpet-bag wedged quite firmly in a fork of the branch. Then, at last, the rope would support me. Meanwhile, I felt my grip on the trunk of the tree beginning to slip. Clinging for dear life with one arm, whilst I feverishly employed the other, I pulled the rope towards me, watching the carpet-bag dangle at the other end. Never before in my life had I truly reached the limit of my strength, and never again do I wish to repeat the experience. Quite without my permission, my limbs simply let go, and helplessly I fell.